Thank you very much, Professor Shenfield. I believe that there is a message of hope in what you have said to us, because while we do still have the problem of the state trying to regulate our lives, which is the negative part of the presentation, I think the affirmative part about the politicians trying to make money is already well underway. So we can take solace from that fact. This is the part of the program where John Lofton was supposed to appear, and he asked me to make his apologies. John has a deadline to meet on a column he is doing entitled about President Nixon, entitled Don't Impeach Him, But Stay on His Back. And that is due Monday, so he cannot be with us. On that theme, I would like to introduce our next speaker, who is an assistant, a legislative assistant, to Senator James Buckley of New York, and is in his own right an acknowledged authority in the realm of foreign policy and defense issues. In addition to his duties with Senator Buckley, he has been a member of the professional staff of the Hudson Institute and was the co-author and co-editor of a very fine anthology on anti-missile defenses called YABM, which I recommend to you if you've not already read it. And he is, in addition, an economist who has studied the economic costs and consequences of defense budgeting in some minute detail. One private piece of information that was conveyed to me about our next speaker was that he has recently returned from a trip to what we refer to as the Nam, Vietnam, and during that trip earned the sobriquet of the Buddha. And there is a kind of scatological reason for that nickname. I think that the probable intention of those who gave him that name was to refer to his manifest inscrutability and his very great wisdom, which I think will be displayed to you as he discusses with us national security policy issues. It is my pleasure to present to you Mr. William Schneider, Jr.
Thank you very much, Stan, and that was certainly a very fine bit of journalistic digging, coming as it does from the youngest editor of a major metropolitan daily newspaper. We heard from last night from Professor Williams, who, among other things, suggested that the our civilization may go out in a whimper, and he suggested a number of titillating scenarios under which that might occur. And this evening, I'd like to suggest that if that doesn't arrive soon, it may go out with a bang before we have an opportunity for it to go out with a whimper. Discussing issues of this kind, I have found no better way of expressing the difficulty in putting some of the remarks together than to draw upon an observation that, or I should say an analogy that Bill Niskanen made on another occasion. He cited the difficulty of saying something interesting to an audience that didn't have a professional concern with national security policy as being analogous to the situation faced by Zsa Gabor's seventh husband, where he clearly knew how to do it, but not necessarily how to make it interesting. This is something like the problem I have in discussing this subject, because as one who watches the details of this thing somewhat minutely, I can find no parallel in recent history when the objective threat, that is, the threat posed to our own physical survival, has ever been greater. Yet, paradoxically, it would seem that never has the perception of an external threat been lower since at least 1948, and perhaps earlier than that. In focusing on these remarks in an effort to abbreviate them, I would just like to focus on one element of our current national security policy, namely the strategic arms limitation negotiations, as a sample of the nature of some of the problems that are facing us. I think this is an important selection just because these problems of SALT deal specifically with strategic forces, and as is not difficult to guess, while we can lose a number of conflicts on the Vietnam model, the number of strategic wars that we can lose probably doesn't exceed one. Moreover, I think that it has become plain from the experience that we had in the Middle East war that strategic nuclear forces provide the most direct means of diplomatic pressure that either of the two superpowers have available to them. Getting a feel for the nature of the problem that we face, this coincidentally being the 10th anniversary of the Philadelphia Society, I'd like to make just a few comparisons between the strategic aggregates, the major measures of the size of our strategic forces and that of the Soviet Union, between the year in which the Society was founded and the current period of time. In 1964, the U.S. had about 800 ICBMs, mostly Minuteman, a few Atlas, and a few Titan missiles. Now we have 1,054, increase of approximately 200, or roughly 25%. Back in 1964, the Soviets had approximately 200 ICBMs. They now have about 1,500, a substantial increase. Similarly, the U.S. had in 1964 about 400 submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and now they have approximately 700. The Soviets had only a handful in 1964. They now have about 650, and under the SALT limits, they will be able to have over 1,000, 1,016, as a matter of fact, by 1977, which at the present rate they should make be able to deploy with considerable ease. There are other measures of our disinvestment in defense, which I just would like to call one's attention to, just because of the very high-powered rhetoric that has surfaced since the end of the Vietnam War about the fact that we're spending a great deal of money on defense. And perhaps in some absolute sense we are, but in certainly in any relative sense compared to, say, what we were spending in 1964, the things look quite different. In terms of what the dollar is buying, just in our general purpose forces, where we had 21 Army and Marine divisions, we now have 19 and a half, despite the fact that we've more than doubled the amount of, or almost doubled the amount that we've expended in payroll to support these forces. There's a lot of other dimensions of this problem, but suffice to say that in the past several years we have disinvested rapidly in defense, while the Soviet Union has invested really incredible amounts of money and effort in defense in ways that have paid off in terms of the of increased diplomatic leverage for the Soviets and a perception in many areas of the world that the U.S. is not willing to stay in the race in some sense. This attitude, I think, has been reinforced by the nature of the SALT Accords. You may remember that the SALT Accords did two things. One of them was to prohibit the deployment of anti-ballistic missile systems at more than a nominal number. This is something that is not worth doing, but was done very well. On the other hand, the SALT Accords attempted also to limit the amount of strategic offensive forces that either side could deploy in the form of submarine-launched ballistic missiles and intercontinental ballistic missiles. This is something that probably is worth doing, given the very high levels at which each side maintains nuclear forces. But this thing was done very badly, to the point where the Soviets were accorded a 3-2 advantage in most of the quantitative measures, except probably the most important measure, the throw weight or the payload capacity of these missiles, where the Soviets have a 4-1 advantage, which they are taking very aggressive efforts to support. I think what is interesting for us to be concerned about is some of the attitudes that this kind of diplomacy reflects, because I think it permeates a lot of the policy actions that the Nixon administration has taken in the past couple of years and is based on what Vice President Ford has said under almost any plausible set of future circumstances for the next couple of years, the policy of the government would not be substantially changed. It reflects, among other things, a basic view that in some way numbers don't matter. That is, even if there are large disparities in forces, that once one side has kill or injure a certain fraction of an opponent's civilian population, that one really doesn't need to be concerned about this. Secretary Kissinger's remarks after the Moscow Accords were signed reflect this, where he cited that if détente worked out, there would be no need to use these forces, and as a consequence, it really didn't matter if there was a disparity, and if détente was a failure, that both sides would have to mobilize, and as a consequence, the exit numbers wouldn't matter much. As a result, much of U.S. policy at the highest levels reflects the notion that the numbers are not really significant. Second observation, which is has one of the views that Secretary McNamara was extremely effective in propagating not only within substantial fractions of the bureaucracy, but more importantly within the Congress, that there is and continues to be a mutual interest in maintaining the vulnerability of each side. That is, there is nothing that the United States should do to try and improve its relative position to that of the Soviets because of perceptions that may lead to an arms race or some other socially undesirable consequence. Also, most importantly, that this the general trend of events with détente and the way it reflects itself in defense policy reflects the view that U.S. and Soviet relations are likely to be permanently stable and in some sort of equilibrium condition, which appears to me to deny the cyclical character of these relations for the past 50 years. Some specific concerns I think we should have in this regard about these policies, and something that is starting to get some attention from the Congress as a consequence of all things the Solzhenitsyn affair, where it is the first time in the past couple of years that a substantial fraction of the Congress began to believe that perhaps the Politburo is suffering from something more than inadequate toilet training, and that they may indeed be a menace worth caring about. At the present time, the U.S.-Soviet détente is uniquely personality-dependent compared to any of our other attempts at improving relations with the Soviets. With the possible exception of the wartime alliance between Roosevelt and Stalin, there was there's really no precedent for this kind of diplomacy, where the administration at this point is trying to persuade Congress that there is an important national interest in maintaining Secretary Brezhnev in power because of the beady-eyed Soviet militarists that are waiting for the least sign of ill health or diplomatic ill weather to displace Secretary Brezhnev. I would argue that when U.S. survival is so personality dependent that it's time to take another look at the premises on which that's based. Another thing I think we should bear in mind is the impact that an expressed willingness to live with these very large asymmetries in the strategic nuclear capabilities of both sides is likely to have not only on our negotiating posture, that is our ability to deal with the Soviets in a political crisis that might come up in the future, but also its impact on the morale and willingness of ordinary U.S. citizens to maintain a defense effort and maintain a perception of a foreign threat. If one gets the idea that the Soviets are somehow entitled to a 3-2 advantage in numbers of strategic delivery vehicles, or alternatively that this advantage really doesn't make a difference, then I think we are sowing some of the seeds of very real problems in the event that there is a serious change in the international climate. And this gets the final set of points I'd like to emphasize as causes for concern, especially from people who share a perception that something could go wrong, and consequently we should be making some efforts now to mitigate the consequences of something going wrong. The first concern I think we should have is the potential erosion of the U.S. ability to mobilize in the event of a political crisis of some kind. We have had a number of periods since World War II where we have taken very strenuous efforts to improve the quality of our and quantity of our strategic forces. The most conspicuous example is during the Korean War, but we also took conspicuous action in the wake of the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s. And as a consequence of the Middle East crisis in 1973, there's also some evidence that at least marginal improvements are being made in the strategic forces. The U.S. has an incredible ability, if appropriate advanced preparations are made, to mobilize for purposes of improving its defense posture if it wishes. There are some conspicuous examples like the U-2 program, where the first U-2 was delivered 90 days after the requirement was established by the intelligence community. When the Soviets exploded their first atomic bomb in 1949, a observation radar was constructed in the winter and up in Point Barrow, a 400-foot radar dish, which is a very fancy device, and this was constructed in about 4 months, which is extremely impressive. And there's lots of examples of this kind on a much larger scale where the U.S. can mobilize. The primary concern, however, is the inattentiveness to an adequate effort in research and development. And this is more serious than is revealed by dollar figures. There has been an increase in effort in research and development in the past couple of years. Most of the increase, however, has gone into the engineering portion of some programs that were already fairly well understood, like the B-1 bomber and the several tactical fighters and things of this kind. These are things that eat up a lot of money, but don't come up with much in the way of new ideas. And it's, I think, very important for more attention to be paid to maintaining the mobilization ability, that is, by investing sufficiently well in research and development so that we have the ability, in the event of a crisis, to go to very high levels of expenditure efficiently and in a short period of time. Second point that I think we should bear in mind is the real possibilities for a breakdown in the international climate. I referred earlier to the personality dependence of U.S.-Soviet relations. There are a number of other occasions where a very major change in the international environment could occur. For example, a lot of speculation has been devoted to the consequences of the demise of Marshal Tito and the problems associated with succession there. And during the 1973 Middle East War, the Soviets demonstrated an ability to airlift lots of equipment quickly, and they, in fact, transshipped some equipment through Yugoslavia. So their entree there in the event of some turmoil could be the kind of example that would produce a real breakdown in international relations, which would require an early response from the United States. And I think it's important that we bear the possibility of these kind of breakdowns in mind so that the appropriate set of actions can be taken that will restore U.S. morale in maintaining a viable defense effort while trying to maintain a clear perception of what its political interests are in the world. Final point that I think bears mention, which I've raised a couple of times, is the issue of threat perception within the United States. If any of you have been in Europe recently, you may have some idea of the consequences of a belief that a foreign threat is not really there. In Germany, the Low Countries, and so forth, there's an incredible suspension of belief in the likelihood of future war. As a result, the morale to maintain a serious defense effort is several years ahead of the United States in terms of collapse. The consequences of this kind of attitude being assimilated into the body politic of the United States is much more serious, however, because my perception is at least that binges of this kind tend to have a much greater amplitude than they have in Western Europe. And the problem of restoring threat perception in an environment when the flight time of a ballistic missile is perhaps a half hour is a very serious problem. So, I'll leave the balance of time for my colleague and some questions.